Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 144 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. I have two guests joining me this week, Vince Houghton and Eric Driggs. Vince grew up in Miami, Florida, and is a veteran of the U.S. Army, where he served in the Balkans. He went on to receive a master's degree and Ph.D. in diplomatic and military history from the University of Maryland. He spent more than 6 years as the historian and curator for the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C., and is now the director of the National Cryptologic Museum, located on the National Security Agency campus at Fort Meade, Maryland. Eric also grew up in Miami and earned his bachelor's degree from Brown University and his master's degree from Harvard Kennedy School. He has worked as a Cuba analyst at the University of Miami's Institute for Cuban and Cuban American Studies, and later served in the U.S. Coast Guard as a governmental and external affairs officer. He's currently a congressional liaison for the United States Southern Command, which oversees all U.S. military activities and operations in Central and South America and the Caribbean. You might remember Vince from his previous episode here on the podcast for episode 130, when we talked about his book Nuking the Moon and Other Intelligence Schemes and Military Plots Left on the Drawing Board. I invited him back today to discuss his newest book, Covert City, The Cold War, and the Making of Miami, which he and Eric co-wrote. It's the story of Miami, Florida in the second half of the 20th century and beyond, and how much the city itself was shaped by the CIA, by Cuban exiles, and by the conflicts that defined the Cold War. By the way, if you're looking for a way to get friends and family as interested in history as you are, or if you want to learn something new and unexpected every month, then make sure to check out History by Mail. Every month, History by Mail will send you reproductions of famous and influential historical documents from American history. Accompanying the documents themselves are articles which put them in the context of their times and help you understand the impact they had on the course of American life. Topics are widely varied, so you're always learning something new across themes that include historic inventions, American wars, and foreign diplomatic relations. I'm really enjoying my own subscription because it's opened my eyes to historic events I knew nothing about. For instance, one of the first packages I received contained a reproduction letter from Annie Oakley to President William McKinley, offering her services as a sharpshooter during the Spanish-American War of 1898. Who knew? Not me. You can subscribe for yourself or gift a subscription at historybymail.com for as little as $6.50 a month. Just click the link in the show notes of this episode and use the discount code JUSTIN10 for a permanent 10% off your subscription. Eric, welcome to the show, and Vince, welcome back.
Thanks, Justin. Thanks. It's great to be back.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Great. I'm glad to do this. This is unusual for me doing a three-person interview, so to speak, but I'm really happy to hear from both of you guys about this subject because it's a very, very deep and complex one, as I'm sure that you guys are aware.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah, Vince.
I would say the hardest part about putting this together was what not to include. This is going to be a 1,000-page book, and it's not, thank God.
I'll bet. Yeah, they can be daunting to read, but I'm sure that every page will be fascinating, just like everything that does appear in the book is. So you mentioned at the end of our last discussion, which was not that long ago, that Covert City would be out soon, and here we are. And, you know, I've mentioned right before we started recording, I've had several different episodes now that they all originate in Miami one way or another. And I've never lived there, but it almost feels like I am, like, personally the intended audience for this book.
Yeah, I mean, there's really an interesting kind of calculation we made when we were writing this. I mean, part of it is the audience is our hometown, like the people who live there and still live there and grew up there. But it's a much broader audience because this is an American story, not just a story of a city. It's a story of one of the most interesting cities in our country. And so we expect, I mean, I think from all the people who have read it so far who don't have a background in, you know, growing up in Miami, have enjoyed it and thought it was really interesting, that this kind of breaks beyond just being a regional study.
Yeah, certainly. I agree. It's for many, many audiences, no doubt about it. So how did you specifically decide to make this the cover of, or the subject of your next book? Was there a incident or event, or were you just thinking like more and more, you know, all the stuff that you already knew, how that needed to be published as it was?
I mean, Eric and I have known each other since like elementary school. So we've been talking, a long time about how crazy the city we grew up in. And eventually we're like, you know, you should write a book about this. And we kind of joked about it for years until finally we end up in the same city, Washington, D.C. area. And we're like, you know what? Now's the time. And what's really great about this thing that we kind of call our hometown is that, you know, we talk about the Cold War in the title. But what started interesting us, that kind of we came of age, we were kind of starting college and becoming a little more aware of the world right after the end of the Cold War. And while everyone else, everywhere else, was kind of moving on to what's next, Miami didn't really change all that much. And so we kind of looked at each other later on and said, the Cold War hasn't ended here, right? There's still this, you know, hardcore anti-Castro, anti-communism. You know, you get the election of 2000 where all of a sudden Cold War issues and communism play a role. And even looking at the election of 2016 and election of 2020, we're still dealing today with what we would kind of consider kind of Cold War intrigue of spies and, you know, international relations focused on this old school capitalism versus communist authoritarian state. You know, and for me, it's always been interesting. I mean, Eric and I have had a lot of conversation about this, and I'm going to let him pick it up from here.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, you look at a lot of the kind of spy kind of breaking news in Miami, you know, even the most recent, the Rocha case and the WASP network, a lot of these, Miami is a central stage. And this book talks a lot about why that's not really all that surprising. I will say one of the things Vince talked about, how this has been, we've been talking about this for years. Vince and I, one of the reasons we talked about it for a while is we're kind of the perfect team to write this book. I mean, if you look at Miami, you look at our backgrounds, we kind of reflect the kind of two main tracks in the city. My name is not the most Cuban one in the world, but both sides of my family were from Cuba. My grandfather was a captain in the Cuban Navy under Batista, and I actually saw his name in some of the research for this book and some clandestine stuff. Vince's family is kind of the other side of Miami, of folks that came before World War II. And so I think we have a really unique perspective on what's going on in the city and kind of why why this is such a compelling story. And that's what we try to capture with the book, I think.
Yeah, I totally agree. I did like the personal touches that you guys put in throughout to kind of connect you to the story. That was it kind of developed the story a little bit more directly, in my opinion.
Yeah, we're either going to piss a lot of people off with this, or we're going to make people content. I think we're going to piss people off, because one of the things I think separates this book from all the other books on Miami, and there are books on Miami in a lot of cases, you know, or long articles or other things, it comes from one perspective or the other, right? You know, kind of like from my side of the fence or from Eric's side of the fence. So there's either the articles or books like Joan Didion's book of Miami, talking about how crazy everybody is and how wacky the Cubans are and how, you know, they're not willing to listen to reason and all this. There's a lot of that for people parachuting into the city to write some kind of think piece on, you know, how ridiculous the Cubans are acting. And then there's people from kind of Eric's side of the fence, you know, are talking about how, you know, the Cuban exile, the great liberators, and they're the ones that are still holding up the American dream. And how dare you call anyone crazy? It's all about freedom and everything else. And don't call us terrorists. Everyone's right and everyone's wrong. And I think that Eric and I kind of come together, and we had a lot of conversations while we're writing this where we push back on each other. And it was a lot of conversations saying, hey, look, you're being a little too one-sided on this. Let's bring some nuance to this. Let's actually understand this from an analytical perspective instead of from one side or the other. Because were there nutso Cuban exiles that went way beyond the pale? Absolutely.
That's a technical term, by the way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. You know, were there crazy programs that ended up being a huge cost to the taxpayer? Sure. But at the same rate, was it just people irresponsible and crazy? No. Like, you can't ignore where the Cuban exile comes from, their story, their perspective. And so for people like me, whose ancestry goes way beyond and way back before all this happened, you know, you want to kind of say, stop. you're being ridiculous. What this looks like to you is because it looks like it to you from a white perspective, from a non-exile perspective. Your country has not just been taken over by a despotic dictator. So shut up, right? You don't understand. And then that's where these conversations and Eric and I kind of come together, because I think what's fascinating about us is we went to all the same schools, had all the same friends, played all the same sports, rooted for all the same teams. All of our lives were essentially identical, but we came at it from entirely different perspectives because of our families. And so where we come from is we had these shared experiences, but they're from different lenses. And those different lenses allowed us to kind of come together and write a book that I feel is way more nuanced than anything else that's come out about Miami up to this point.
Yeah, that's terrific. I was really wondering what it was like to co-author a book, and you guys have really laid it all out. And that's great to not come at it with, a, you know, like a carbon copy of yourself, just taking over half the chapters or something like that, because I do see those differences kind of shine through a little bit and give more depth to the book as well.
That's great to hear. Thanks. Yeah, that's what we were going for a little bit.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. It's rare for me to read a book that is co-authored, other than occasionally, you know, people who experience a real world event but have no, you know, writing experience or whatever, they'll have a co-author like a sign from the publisher, it seems like. But other than that, you know, I haven't really interviewed or read very many books by true co-authors like you guys.
Yeah, they're rare. I mean, they're just, you don't usually have two people that have very unique but similar perspectives that can kind of come together and do something like this. And and we just jumped at the opportunity because, you know, again, we've been friends for a long, long time. And this, surprisingly, I mean, I'm speaking for myself, Eric can chime in. This didn't really test our friendship all that much. I was expecting it to, you know, we're going to be like, we're not going to talk to you for a month until you cool off. But no, I mean, there were times when he was very honest and he's like, Vince, you're looking at this from a perspective that is not reality. And I was like, well, whatever. And then I'm like, yeah, you know what? Let me take a step back and look at this. And I'm like, you know what? You're right. You know, let's talk about how we can make this work.
Yeah. And on the same end, I was like, hey, Vince, there's a sentence in here that I'm not too comfortable with, and it's going to really tick a lot of people off. And he's like, that's kind of good. That's kind of what we're going for. And there's value in that. You know, he kind of talked me off the ledge a little bit a couple times too. So there was a really big, a good amount of give and take that I think, as you mentioned, kind of adds nuance to it. This was my maiden voyage in authoring anything. This was my rookie season. It was good to have someone who's done this before and kind of knows the ropes a little bit. That was really, really helpful. And it was actually kind of fun. I mean, you know, Vince has a very kind of conversational style of writing. You've talked about Nuking the Moon on this podcast. And it was funny because I was reading the book. I was literally like chuckling to myself because I grew up with him and I can hear him like through the pages. Like, this is exactly how he talks. And he's been talking that way since we were in high school, talking about, you know, the Panthers in the Stanley Cup or Miami Hurricane football. It's just funny to kind of see it on the written page. And we tried to kind of meld that and we tried to make it so that it was hard to tell who was writing which chapter. We tried to make speak with one voice. And it's easy when you've known each other for over 20 years, I think.
I'll bet. Well, yeah, I was going to say the tone of both books it's a lot lighter, you know, than some of most of the books that I've read, because, you know, these subjects are inherently pretty serious in a lot of ways, but it works really well. You know, both of these books have been like kind of a breath of fresh air for me, because you do get a few laughs here and there. And some of these situations are just inherently ridiculous, you know, across both books. So it's okay to, I don't know if I'd say poke fun at it, but, you know, certainly acknowledge the humor inherent in some of these ridiculous situations that have come about over the past 75 years or so.
I mean, if it's not interesting, then why read it, right? I mean, it's one of those where it's always been my philosophy of if you're going to write something so boring that you're struggling through it. Look, as someone with a doctorate in history, I've read thousands of books, and there are some where I'm like, I know this is an important book. I know I have to read it, but God, I don't want to. Right, where you're just like, God, so, you know, you're reading a paragraph twice to make, which you're like dozing off in the middle of one. And like, it doesn't have to be that way, right? You can write serious history and still, you know, make it to where people want to read it. And I think that's what we've all, you know, Eric and I have the same personality in that respect, is that we want this to be a almost, that conversational is the wrong word perhaps, because we're not journalists, right? But we want this to be serious history, but told in such a way that when you read it, you're kind of, you're enjoying being told. It's almost storytelling, you know, with serious history behind it. And that's what's great about this. These are amazing stories, right? These are just awesome stories. I mean, some of the coolest things is that Eric has his grandfather's archive, for lack of a better word, right? So all these documents that are have been passed down to him, and the stories they tell are just amazing. This is a funny, like, inside baseball story. When we were doing the notes, the end notes, and the copy editor was like, "What archive is this?" And I'm like, it's at Eric's house.
That's right.
It's in a Tupperware bin in Eric's basement.
I'm literally looking at it right now.
It's the drink. So we decided, we're like, we're just going to call it the Driggs Family Archive. it's a container store bin holding all these documents.
Sorry,
all
the archive, Mom and Dad.
All the archivists out there are like, "What? What do you mean?" But yeah, I mean, that's kind of where we're dealing with. Eric is, his family is so much part of the story that it's just fascinating. I love just hearing about the Exile Navy and all the different interesting parts that I had never heard of before. I mean, as much as I've read about the subject, these are things that I just didn't know about myself.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I know we'll dig into all that in a minute here. A lot, just, my gosh, just it really is incredible, the breadth of stories there. So how far back does Miami's connection to, you know, international intrigue go? I mean, the city's been around a long time.
I mean, if you talk about the city of Miami, it's different than talking about that South Florida region. The South Florida region goes back to the time of the pirates, right? I mean, these are areas that were used by some of the famous pirates for smuggling. But as far as the city is concerned, you're really talking about kind of the rum runner days of Prohibition. And that's kind of like where the mob moves in. That's where Eric can talk about this even more than I can, because the Coast Guard is really the predominant military branch that's dealing with that.
Yeah, so I'm still a drilling reservist in the Coast Guard, and right now there's the Coast Guard 7th District headquarters is in Miami, Florida, which they basically cover from South Carolina through the Caribbean, and that's no accident. It's a very, very active area. You know, as Vince said, you know, you got the Bahamas right there and the Keys, both of which are basically tailor-made for smuggling. There's a ton of ungoverned islands and whatnot. So yeah, the rum runners and those folks. Miami was established as a city like in 1925. So it's a pretty young city. And that was right when this stuff, you know, really started popping off a couple years later. You know, some history folks know that Al Capone was actually nabbed in Miami for tax evasion and not all the other nasty business he was involved in. So I guess as an incorporated city, I would agree with Vince that that's probably the first kind of run in with skullduggery and nefarious business, but it definitely wasn't the last.
Well, it never looked back from
right.
that point.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
It was established then and then just kept on going. I mean, you don't really have a break at that point. Just who replaces whom as the top dog of the scoundrels and mm-hmm. scallywags. To me, the interesting thing about this is it's always kind of been this lawless area. Like even at times when there wasn't a reason to have it's like the 80s, right, where the drugs and other things like that are a big part of smuggling. It's the outskirts of the outskirts, right? You know, Florida as a state is already kind of the extreme edge of the United States, and then Miami is extreme edge of the extreme edge. And anyone who's lived there knows that, you know, right now we live in the Washington, D.C. area. So if I drive 3 hours in any direction, I go through like 8 states. If I drive right. 8 hours in from Miami, I'm still in Florida. And so it's, you know, we're as far away as you can get. And that allows a bit of independence from all the kind of norms of the rest of society. And people for decades have been taking advantage of that. And they still are.
Yeah, the Florida man is a real phenomenon, as we all know. And the Miami subset of Florida man foolishness is kind of a whole other level, I think.
I'll bet. There's a line, it was in your book, actually, and I guess it's pretty common. I think that was the first time I heard it, though, that there's a mention that the great thing about living in Miami is that you're so close to the United States.
Yeah.
I think.
Well, I mean, the idea also is that you can do this either direction, but the farther you drive south in Florida, the more north you get.
Oh,
and
really?
So it's this wonderful mishmash. And that's Eric and I's backstory, right? My dad came down to Miami in the 40s because his father was sent down there as a naval engineer
to turn one of the major hotels in Miami, the Biltmore, into a VA hospital. And so my dad came down from Boston, and so he's the snowbird of the North. And then Eric's family came in from the Caribbean. And so that's really what populated South Florida and Miami for this time. And so it became this hodgepodge of obviously the Latin influence, but also the Northern influence. There are very few people who are like five generation Miamians. It's just, you don't find that very often. And so it's this really crazy, people called it a melting pot back when we lived there, but now it's a true melting pot because it's not just Cubans and, you know, the pre-Cuban whites in the black population. Now you have Haitians, you have all the other Caribbeans, you have all the other South Americans, you have the Russians are there, you know, Europeans are there. Today, it's about as crazy full. That's why we call it Mos Eisley Cantina near the end of the book, because it is a full scale hodgepodge of characters, for lack of a better term.
Mm-hmm. I'll bet. And I know that a major focus, you know, you talk about quite a few different groups and cultures and enclaves and that sort of thing throughout. But of course, a major focus is the Cuban exiles. So can you talk a little bit about how that really kicked into high gear starting, I assume, right around beginning of 1960 or so, how that changed the city and what those people did once they arrived?
Yeah, so obviously January 1, 1959 kind of changed things on the island. And it became clear pretty early on that what the revolution had promised was not really what was quite coming to pass. And you started seeing huge influxes of Cubans, and most of them resided in Miami because it's close. And I don't think anyone at that point could have possibly envisioned that, you know, these bearded barbarians that came down from the mountains in Cuba would be in power 60 something years later. I think everyone thought this was kind of a flash in the pan and it wouldn't last very long. A lot of the book kind of starts talking about how the exiles, when they got to the United States, started organizing themselves. It was an absolute explosion of organizations. I mean, everyone, there were armed organizations, but there were, you know, I mean, all kinds of civic organizations and all kinds of things. You know, we started this discussion talking about how a lot of people look at Miami and be like, well, these are a bunch of crazy Cubans. And the book actually starts talking about Jose Marti, who is kind of the George Washington and like the poet laureate of Cuba all wrapped into one. And you really can't understand the Cuban exile experience without kind of understanding his. And so Cuba became, they liberated themselves from Spain very late in the game. And all of those struggles had folks in the United States trying to basically raise money and arms and personnel to invade Cuba. It's really unsurprising when you look at what happened in Miami in the 60s and the Cuban exiles started organizing themselves to raise funds, to get weapons and get personnel to try and overthrow the government in Cuba, because that has been the history of Cuba from its beginning. So there's an emotional piece of this too that I think if you're not in that situation, it's hard to understand. Cuba is a very young country, especially in the 60s. You know, they raised the Cuban flag in Havana in 1902 for the first time as an independent country. So the idea of being part of a second liberation of your country when the first liberation of your country is still within living memory is something that is difficult for, I think, Americans to understand. It's almost like something happened, you know, several years after the Battle of Yorktown and, you know, they asked a bunch of people to take up arms. It was incredibly emotional and it was an opportunity to be a part of history. And I think that's part of why you saw so many people getting organized and getting involved.
Well, it's a bit like if we had lost the War of 1812, right? And the idea of the British came back in and took power back against us, we would not just sit back and take it, right? We would have been like, oh, well, we tried.
Right.
You know, we
good game, guys. Good game.
We all moved to French Louisiana and just start speaking French. No, we would have organized and we would have gone back in and done what was necessary. And that was the mentality here. And I think what the book points out, what I was completely surprised about was when Eric, I assumed, like a lot of people do, that everyone came to Miami and all kind of organized and under one banner of like, we're all going to join up and we're going to go take back Cuba. And then he started throwing these names at me. And the book does, I think, a great job of, like, it's paragraph after paragraph after paragraph of all these different groups that formed under different leadership. And, you know, they all had similar names. It was like the Organization of the Democracy in Cuba, or Democracy in Cuba Organization, or the Coalition for Democratic Cuba. And they're all small groups run by, you know, some charismatic leader. And very few of them were kind of working together. And so it took a while. That's why you don't have immediate reaction to the Cuban Revolution. That's why it takes a couple of years for them to, excuse my French, get their shit together before they somewhat coalesce under particular leader who is the one that organizes what becomes the Bay of Pigs invasion.
Yeah. Was this just a function of people not quite consolidating yet? Or was there a lot of, I don't know if that's a competitiveness among the groups or major disagreements about what should go forward? I mean, I'm shocked that they would form hundreds of different groups rather than, you know, consolidate fairly quickly, since they all had that shared experience and this shared adversary as well.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting. I mean, that, man, I really felt for these guys. I was doing research, and they sent some CIA guys down to Miami to try to get their hands on, basically get a handle on what was going on down there. And these, I was just picturing these guys. They were probably just chugging coffee and 2 hours of sleep for weeks at a time, because they ended up coming up with basically a handbook for CIA folks to get an understanding of the pantheon of organizations. And I counted 415 of these organizations. Oh, and this was like in the early 60s. So this was only after a couple of years. You know, you talked about earlier about kind of being able to chuckle at the, just kind of the craziness that comes up in these things. And yeah, Vince mentioned there's like five or six organizations that all have the same, you know, acronyms. And my favorite one, which gets kind of a little bit of love in the book, there's one called the National Anti-Communist Liberation Front, which in Spanish, the acronym is FLAN, which for the foodies of the world, it's a delicious caramel custard. So I don't know if they were just having fun with it, or if they thought that, you know, the idea of a too sweet dessert would strike fear in the hearts of communists everywhere. I'm not quite sure, but it was just a crazy time. And I think they didn't quite coalesce because Cuba was still kind of in its infancy in terms of, you know, it was a democracy, but it was a bucking bronco ride. They were still figuring it all out. And so there were tons of political parties back then, and none of that changes just because you change your zip code or your country. So there were a lot of differing opinions on what Cuba should look like and who should be the leader and, you know, all that sort of thing. So it was interesting times, to be sure.
Well, one thing that I think is important to know is that, and Eric, you can speak to this because you've told me this, is most people didn't like Bautista very much. And so a lot of people, when Bautista was kicked out of power, were like, you know what, let's wait and see if this is any better. And it wasn't. I mean, Castro, you know, at first says he's not a communist. He comes and gives interviews in English in the United States. You know, I'm not a communist, literally at the same time that his brother Raul and Che Guevara are in Moscow. And so there are people who are like, you know what, Bautista was a horrible butcher, and maybe this will be better. But it didn't take long before people realize that this is not going to be a better situation.
Yeah, fun story. I mean, that's that's kind of my family story. My grandfather was in the Navy under Batista. There was an uprising against Batista because, as Vince mentioned, he was not so popular being a dictator. My grandfather wasn't really a part of it, but he was thrown in prison. And he was given the option to leave the country, and he took it versus rotting in prison. And so my dad's side of the family, one of the few, I think, that left twice, because they left under Batista. And then when Castro took over, they said, well, great. I mean, this guy can't be worse than Batista. So here's our chance. Let's go back. And they did. And it became very clear that there is such a thing as worse than Batista.
Yeah.
I think in hindsight, if we were able to kind of Monday morning quarterback this, there probably would be but a lot more coming together if the exiles realized the Castro family or that the Castroism would still be there 60 years later. Yeah. As Eric mentioned, they all thought this was temporary. They all thought they were not going to be setting up roots in Miami, that they were just reorganizing. And one way or another, they're going to go back in and take them out. And so I think that that is something that prevents them from coming together, because I think they don't realize how deeply rooted the Castro family and Castroism would become in Cuba with the secret police and everybody else. And so maybe they, again, this is counterfactual. If they had known, maybe they would have put aside some of their differences and actually come together and actually create a legitimate opposition.
Sure, sure. That's very understandable. And yeah, I guess it was quite some time before they really saw Miami as their new home in many cases. I take it that was just kind of where they were regrouping to retake their true home.
Absolutely. Well, Eric, and that's a great way of putting it. Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Vince.
I mean, Eric, no, I'm saying you're so good at talking about this, but I think that's when this true transformation of Miami takes place. You know, the early 60s is like kind of military transformation, right? Where you have the Cuban Missile Crisis and Bay of Pigs, and the CIA is doubling and tripling in size. We could talk about that. But it's the realization after the Cuban Missile Crisis, especially, because there is this non-intervention pledge, that the Cubans in Miami realize they're going to be there for a while, and they really start transforming the city.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which is fair that it took a little bit of time, because, you know, I mean, at that point, again, it's easy to look back now, but at that time, the idea, particularly when, you know, when Cuba starts aligning itself with the Soviet Union, and Cubans weren't the only ones who thought this, the idea of a Soviet satellite 90 miles off American shores was, I mean, everyone, all the Cubans in Miami were like, there's no way that the United States is going to permit this, right? That's an understandable conclusion to come to. So yeah, it wasn't until years later that it looked like this is going to be kind of the status quo for a while that they started setting down roots.
Right, right. Understandable. So I've gone over the actual like Bay of Pigs invasion. And you know, I think my listeners are pretty well familiar with that in general right now. But one thing that I was totally shocked by about your book was the JM Wave Station, which I definitely knew a few things about. And I've actually visited the old building, which is the Miami Military Museum now. Mm-hmm. I had no idea just how truly big that got. So you mentioned earlier, I guess they sent down just like a handful of guys to kind of evaluate the exiles initially. But how big did that presence grow in Miami over the years?
Yeah, I mean, the original CIA contingent in Miami was one guy with a couple clerks. And essentially his job was to interview the exiles coming out of Cuba for any kind of useful information that we might care about. And as the numbers started growing, his staff grew a little bit. And, you know, he was given extra people, not all from CIA. He actually had people seconded from different agencies in Miami, whether it was Border Patrol or FBI or others. Anyone who could speak Spanish, basically, was brought over to interview these people as they were coming out. As things become more problematic, for instance, as it becomes clear that the Soviets are now involving themselves in Cuba, as it becomes clear that Castro is now turning his attention toward courting the Soviets, as Eric mentioned, as a satellite state 90 miles from Key West, JM Wave explodes. It becomes the second largest CIA facility in the world, with only Langley, the headquarters of the CIA, being bigger. It's the only one of any size in the United States. As your listeners probably know, CIA stations are overseas. This is one that's actually in the United States, operating as though it were an overseas station. Money is flowing in there by the tens of millions. There's a wonderful statistics. We couldn't prove the numbers, but the urban legend behind it is understandable, that at one point in the early 60s, the CIA was responsible for one-third of Miami's economy. And this is a major U.S. city, and even, you know, not as big or important as it is today, you know, that it grows into that, but it's still, you know, hundreds of thousands of people in this area, and one-third of the economy comes from the CIA. And that again, is because you have hundreds of CIA officers on payroll there. You have thousands of Cuban exiles on the payroll, and every single one of them needs houses, cars, furniture for their houses. They all go to the movies. They all need clothes. They all need places to train. So you have real estate being bought and sold. There's safe houses that need to be purchased. Weapons need to be purchased. Boats, the third largest navy in the Caribbean, behind the United States Navy and the Cuban Navy, was the CIA's Navy. And actually, Eric's grandfather played a role in this as well. There were three or four people on staff at JM Wave whose job it was just to buy and sell real estate. because they wanted to kind of keep the safe houses rotating and moving during that time. So you have one entity, the CIA, who's responsible for a full third of Miami's economy. So talk about going from one guy with a couple clerks to just about 2 years later having thousands of people on the payroll. That's how quickly this changed.
Yeah, that was shocking to me. I believe you quoted in the book something like, including the exiles, something like 15,000 people. Like CIA was the largest single employer in Miami.
Right. The largest single employer in the whole city, because, you know, you are counting quote unquote contractors, right? These are exiles on payroll, but that's where the money's coming from. And Eric writes a great chapter that follows this one, where it talks about the transformation of the city because of all this money that moves in there. They all start creating small businesses and banks and restaurants and all these things that you don't look at it today. And there's no money trail that says CIA was the reason for the establishment of Cayocho and Little Havana, all these things. But that's where the money came from, right? It didn't come from anywhere else, right? It came from the U.S. government. And so the development of this identity in Miami and all these different Cuban-owned businesses were because of agency money being just absolutely dumped into the city to combat the Cuba problem.
Before we go on, I want to tell you all about a new podcast from Tenderfoot TV called To Die For. Imagine you were a fly on the wall at a dinner between the Mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where this unprecedented podcast begins. Brought to you by the makers of the hit podcast To Live and Die in LA, To Die For marks the first time a Russian-trained honey trap has told her story from beginning to end. Taught to seduce men for their secrets, and sometimes their lives, Alia Rosa was trained to believe that her body no longer belonged to her. It belonged to the state. She was meticulously trained to be the perfect weapon, able to seduce her targets into compromising situations that have ended careers, and sometimes lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the studio that brought you Up and Vanished, and To Live and Die in LA, make sure you check out To Die For, available beginning on March 26th, wherever you get your podcasts. Yeah, what a wild change that must have been for the whole city. Did the residents of the city, like the non-Cuban residents, do you get an indication that they're like, what is going on here? Like did they fully understand that it was Cuban exiles and the U.S. government making all these drastic changes? Or did they just think that they were in some sort of, you know, boom period because the front companies were, you know, not affiliated officially with the CIA?
But everyone knew they were CIA. Yeah. So my father and my mother were both undergrads at the University of Miami during this time period. That's where they met. And my dad's roommate, the year before he had graduated, his car was broken down, so he needed a ride. And so he asked my dad for a ride to work, and my dad drove him south on US 1 to 152nd Street, where today the zoo is, and hung a right, and he's like, oh, hang a left here, and pulls in. My dad turns to his friend and says, I didn't know you worked for the CIA. Because everyone in Miami knew that this was a CIA station, except for the people at the CIA station. They're the only ones who are oblivious to the fact that it was the worst kept secret in the city.
Oh, man.
So all these, it was called Zenith Technical Enterprises, Zenith Technical Industries, and then it becomes, of all these front companies, it didn't fool anybody. The only people who thought it was fooling people were the people at CIA. Everyone else in Miami knew that the CIA had come, and look, it was obvious, right? We weren't doing our jobs as a nation, as a foreign policy, unless there was a massive presence there trying to get Castro out of power. Eric mentioned it a while ago. You do not allow a communist state who is just rolling out the red carpet for the Soviets 90 miles from Key West. And so people accepted that. It was one of these things where, yeah, all right, it's the CIA. They're doing their thing. You know, we understand they're doing their thing, and they should be. Again, think about most of the people who are settled, who are non-Cuban in Miami at this point, came during the World War II period or right after the World War II period. So they're baby boomers who are having, you know, soldiers who came back from the war, like my father was born of a soldier who was at the war, you know, or they're the generations that are still being trained as pilots because one of the top training centers was down in Miami. So these are not, you know, these are not hippies, right? This is not the Woodstock crowd. Like these are people who have this kind of patriotic spirit, who are rah-rah USA. And so they're very much for this happening. And no one's going to argue with the amount of money that's coming here because the businesses are doing great, right? The furniture stores are loving life because they're selling all these new couches and beds to the CIA personnel and the exiles. The car dealerships are loving life because they're making a ton of money, everyone buying all these cars. So why would you argue with that? Why would you push back? It really wasn't until 1980 that the real pushback begins, and that's skipping ahead a little bit, but that's a whole other ballgame.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. So not long after all of this, you know, the Cuban Missile Crisis occurs, and it turns into almost like a military-occupied city, not just CIA-occupied in a way. Can you talk about that a little bit, the defenses that were set up and that sort of thing?
Yeah, so, I mean, this is very, very temporary, right? So this really only happens over a period of about a month, but essentially entire divisions of troops move down into the South Florida area. It becomes essentially a militarized city where Miami National Airport and then Tamiami Airport and these other ones that are around there become essentially temporary barracks for entire divisions of troops. You also have, which are still there, at least the remnants of them are still there, anti-ballistic missile, for lack of a better word, they really weren't anti-ballistic missile in the 1960s, systems like the Nike ground-to-air nuclear missile that was designed to shoot down any kind of bombers or missiles coming in with a nuclear warhead, right? So no one really thought that one through, but we won't need to get to that too much. The Nike sites are still part of, if you go down to Miami and take the Cold War tour from History Miami, they'll bring you out to some of the Nike missile sites out in the Everglades. They're still there. The missiles aren't, but the sites are. That's an interesting tour to take. And you had Homestead Air Force Base, which is now Homestead Air Reserve Base, but it was a fully formed Air Force Base at the time, had entire air wings moving down there. Because if we do, remember, the two options were blockade or quarantine, as the Kennedy administration called it, or an invasion. And if there was an invasion that took place, that's where it would jump off from, right? So think of England before D-Day, right? The amount of forces that were amassing across the English Channel that were going to go into Normandy, that's what was amassing in Miami at this point, getting ready for this big push into Cuba. And the one little added element to that also is the agency, CIA, and everyone else had all sorts of assets there ready to go in as well, ready to assist the invasion, but also go in as pathfinders beforehand and parachute in and go in as ways to take out high-level Cuban leadership and other things that obviously doesn't happen because the invasion doesn't take place. But this was a fortress Miami at this point.
Yeah, it's hard for me to imagine the level of tension at that time in the city with the distance. Like if it actually kicks off, we will certainly know it fast if we survive.
There would not be a lot of warning in South Florida, that's for sure.
Right. So I wanted to ask you also about Operation Mongoose, which I've heard a little bit about, and I know that that was kind of based out of Miami, but it was more of like a series of operations, right? Not just a single focus. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, so people have talked about Mongoose a lot because it's kind of sexy. It obviously overlaps with stuff like the Kennedy assassination. It becomes this, you know, evergreen way of pointing at how devious American covert action is. The real secret of Operation Mongoose is it didn't do anything. It's the biggest nothing burger. There are a lot of plans. There are a lot of training for certain operations. There are a lot of things that attempted to put in place. But really, at the end of Mongoose, you could point to it and say not a damn thing had been accomplished that was part of the planning. And so to me, it's much ado about nothing. I think that it's very easy to point to very specific programs within Mongoose, like Northwoods and others, that are like, ooh, look at this. Look how terrible we were. They were just ideas. Would they have wanted to pull them off? Sure. Could they have? No. They just got to the point where nothing had been accomplished by the time you get to the Cuban Missile Crisis, at which point there was no Operation Mongoose anymore. It was completely folded up because we're not going to start World War III over this. And that's really what the realization was. So people love bringing up Mongoose. I kind of just chuckle. And I go, do you really know how little was accomplished by this program that gets so much press and so much attention? Mm-hmm. It basically was a complete waste.
Yeah, it does seem like I guess looking across the whole breadth of policy, I mean, just like you said earlier, Castro died of natural causes at a very advanced age. So how effective was basically any of our policy pointed toward Cuba since 1959, in a sense, because that was kind of the last thing that we ever wanted to happen. And yet that's the end result.
Yeah, the only way that American covert action was successful in killing Castro was if there's a top secret document somewhere that was, let Castro live long enough to smoke cigar himself to death of old age, yeah. Then yeah, mission accomplished. We pulled that one off. But yeah, there was nothing successful other than that.
Right, right. So one of the things going to the Cuban policies of the time, and that was honestly something that I've not covered because it's not really specifically related to espionage, but it was very, very interesting to me, was the way that Castro's kind of policy about exiles and immigration and the way that he would allow and even push people to leave if they were not fully on board with his plans. Can you talk about that and how that also changed Miami a bit?
So, you know, again, I grew up in a Cuban American household where Fidel Castro is a name that is not mentioned without a litany of expletives. However, just about everyone begrudgingly recognizes that Fidel Castro was one of the greatest political minds in the 20th century, in the sense of he was Machiavellian, to be sure, but he was incredibly sharp. And I think he realized better than just about anyone the opportunity that geography had provided him. And what I mean by that is he recognized that he was the leader of a revolution that had a significant percentage of his population actively against. And I think he realized very early on he could either use a lot of that revolution's resources to punish and spy on and watch these people, which they did, but those resources are finite and limited, right? And so I think he realized very early on that when pressure started getting very high on the island, and you see this over his time in Cuba, once the pressure cooker gets to a certain point, he just allows people to leave. And that does any number of things on the domestic side, meaning for him, it alleviates a bunch of people who are dissidents and potential threats to him. And it makes it easier to control whoever's left. It also, over the years, becomes a huge kick in the pants to the Yankees. And I think he really relished doing that. He did it multiple times. And the book talks about some of the largest movements of people that were clearly orchestrated by Castro. I mean, nothing happens on that island, didn't happen on that island without his say-so. So it was actually a brilliant move, and one that he used more than once. It indelibly changed Miami. I mean, it just, you had waves of folks at different points that ended up settling in Miami and kind of changing, particularly after, you know, as we mentioned, it became clear that this was going, we were going to play the long game with this. As Vince mentioned, the top secret way of eliminating Castro is with decades of aging. They started setting down roots, and they basically started kind of shaping Miami in the image of what they had lost. And it was beautiful and heartbreaking at the same time, right? And that's why, like, there's an emotional piece to this. It's a great espionage story and a lot of intrigue and all this, but it is also like one of the most heartbreaking stories. And I guess because I'm in the middle of it, but there are pieces of Miami that obviously Calle Ocho, you know, 8th Street is famous as kind of the epicenter of Little Havana. And it's called Little Havana for a very good reason. They tried to replicate what they remembered, right? So the little coffee windows that are all over the place in Miami. I remember growing up, there's a seawall in this like beach park. It's tiny. But my parents would take us there and talk about the Malecón, which is, you know, the huge seawall in Havana, a lot of people know. It was a multi-generational attempt to try and reclaim what was lost. And Miami kind of became the, I guess, the blank slate for them to start recreating Cuba, I suppose. So,
And this is where I jump in and make it not so pretty. Eric made it wonderfully beautiful. And now the cynic in me comes in and says, Justin, you probably should know this story, because one of the great things about people like Eric's parents and a lot of the other exiles is when new exiles showed up, they were welcomed with open arms. They were helped to get jobs. They're helped to create businesses. They were welcomed into communities. And what Castro was able to do when he released thousands of people at a time was to sprinkle in Cuban intelligence officers into the exiles who were sent over to Miami. And those people were welcomed with open arms because they were seen to be exiles from Castro's Cuba, and they were able to integrate themselves into exile communities, into Miami communities. This is what happened with the WAS network. This is what happened with any number of Cuban intelligence officers who were able to come over without having to sneak in because they were part of large exile groups. The common, you see different numbers, there's no way to know for 100% sure what we're talking about. But during the Mariel boat lift in 1980, we're talking dozens, if not hundreds, of Cuban intelligence officers traveled to Miami along with all the people seeking a better life and were able to very easily infiltrate into South Florida society.
And the Mariel boat lift was really a kind of, I would say, kind of Castro's masterstroke in this, you know, using weapons of mass migration, in the sense that up until then, like Vince said, everyone saw everyone coming over as, in the Cuban community, I mean, and in Miami in general, saw them as freedom-loving people who are, I mean, they were poster children for the Cold War, right? I mean, this is the Western Hemisphere equivalent to people jumping the Berlin Wall, right? They are making a very dangerous choice. They're leaving everything that they know for freedom and democracy in the American way. The Mariel boat lift basically put a torch to all that. And Fidel was absolutely just publicly just injected just enough doubt and released just enough people who were prisoners in his jails and criminals and all this sort of thing. Just that amount of doubt completely changed. They called them Marielitos, the ones that arrived from the Mariel boat lift. And even among the Cuban community, they had a reception that was very different than all the other Cubans before them. And it took them decades to kind of shun the, you know, kind of shake that kind of badge of dishonor that being a Marielito was at first. And all of that was because of how Fidel Castro kind of couched the discussion of it. You know, the public kind of took it like hook, line, and sinker. You know, there's stuff in the book about that happened in 1980. They were asking people, Miamians, who, again, up to that point had been very receptive and very open to people looking for a new life. They had a poll, I think it was in like 1981. This is not a poll that I think you can have these days. But they had a list of people, and they said, which of these groups would you say is the least desirable to have as next-door neighbors? And Cubans were number two. The only persons who were least desirable were apparently cult leaders.
Oh, my gosh.
So a radical change in a very short amount of time. And that's why I, again, from a Machiavellian standpoint, that may have been Fidel Castro's, I mean, he really knocked it out of the park with Mariel, unfortunately, from that standpoint.
Yeah. Yeah. That certainly sounds like it. He got rid of the undesirables. He got rid of the dissidents and also sowed distrust in the community of people most likely to oppose him overseas. That's a masterstroke for sure. And I think you mentioned in the book as well, like the prologue of the movie Scarface is with him coming over as one of the Marielitos, right? And then that kind of indelibly linked the boat lift with in the imagination of the American public.
100%. Right? Yeah. I remember, so I went to college up in the Northeast, and I remember my roommate, I was the first Cuban he had ever met. He was from Massachusetts. He literally was like, the only other Cuban I know is Tony Montana and Scarface. I'm like, oh, that's awesome. Okay, great. This is going to be a lovely time together. But yeah, I mean, Scarface, and that really kind of, I think to this day, still, I mean, you know, a lot of people think of the Mariel boat lift, they think of Tony Montana, you know, which a great movie, but not if it's about you.
Right. Yeah, that would cast a shadow.
The media in Miami and around the country played a huge role in this. And Castro was a master at playing the American media like a fiddle also, because the percentage of scumbags in Mariel was very small, right? That, you know, this is a very small percentage of crooks and, you know, people released from, you know, insane asylums and people who come over and cause problems. But every single time there was a shooting or there was something involved with anyone even remotely tied to Marielle, it was the headline, right? It was Marielitos come and shoot up Dadeland Mall.
Oh, wow.
And well, and that there's a show that is streaming called Griselda, and it's about Griselda Blanco, who was the drug kingpin down in Miami. And it, even today, right, in 2024, when the show came out, it really kind of couches the Marielitos as like these gangbangers who come over from Cuba. And that was such a minuscule percentage of the people who came over during that time. The vast majority of the people are looking for, people are looking for better lives. Mm-hmm. And it just, because of kind of the press coverage of that, you really get a different perspective. And look, I grew up, and until very recently, I had heard, and I, you know, I even wrote this, I think in a first draft of this, where it's like, he opened the jails, he opened the insane asylums. And Eric's like, okay, but people who are in jail weren't jail for robbing banks, they're in jail for political reasons. And people who are in insane asylums were put there because they didn't worship Castro. And so they were considered. And so it's like, these are not, this isn't like the Joker being sent over, right? These aren't crazy, you know, Hannibal Lecters coming over. These are people who are political prisoners or who are actually sent to an insane asylum. They're committed because they're not 100% pro-Castro communism. And that's, I have that mentality before Eric told me that because of what I had grown up hearing from local Miami media.
Criminality in Cuba is a much different concept than we have here in the United States. I think I mentioned it in the book, there was a law in Cuba for many, many years. If you remember the movie Minority Report, which mm-hmm. is basically like, you know, it's in the future and like there's basically this like pre-crime law where they can arrest people, you know, before they commit a crime. That was actually a law on the books in Cuba for many, many years. And they called it the law of dangerousness, which basically meant if the Cuban government thought that you were someone who had the proclivity to commit any kind of crime, they could actually throw you in prison. The storyline, while true, I'm sure there were many people released from prisons. I think it's important to note, A, the number of people released from prison was very small. And B, their reasons for being in prison were very, very different than what we're used to seeing people in prison for in the United States.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And I can see how taking that news initially at face value, you have to look into it deeper later on. You're like, oh, wow, that does make a lot more sense that, you know, they would view criminals in a very different light than we do. So I'm curious, between the distrust of the Marielitos and the sprinkling of the like the DGI agents in there, did this kind of like tear the Cuban community apart in Miami for a while? Like, you know, they thought Castro had eyes and ears everywhere or something like that?
Well, go ahead, Vince.
No, Eric, I mean, there's two different answers to this. So Eric, handle the Cuban community and I'll handle the whiteies because there is a different answer to this. I think what is interesting growing up in the 80s and the 90s about perception there.
So well, I mean, I was going to say, I think there was always, I mean, among the Cuban community, and I think you asked a while back about why there was so much division and all this sort of stuff from the beginning, right? And there was always an element of who can you trust? Are you an operative, right? And I think that comes from a very good, I mean, it's a very logical position to have. I think over the years we've seen, and very recently, Cuban intelligence is some of the best in the world. And as you mentioned earlier, the most threatening place to the Cuban government was Miami, Florida, and probably remains Miami, Florida. I suspect that they are using a lot of the intelligence resources that they have to keep an eye on Florida, and particularly Miami. So I don't know to specifically answer the question. I think that had always been an element of the Miami exile community was, you know, there's a level of kind of suspicion that kind of makes it kind of made it hard, I think, to coalesce into a cohesive unit for many years because that was kind of an undercurrent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, Vince, what was your perspective on that?
You said my perspective on the Miami not being kind of together on this was exactly what we were just talking about with Marielle. And my father's a great example of this. My mom, not as much because, you know, she loved everybody, but my dad was kind of a grumpy, you know, baby boomer who loved the Cubans who came over pre-1980. Because, as he said, and this is what I grew up on, you know, they're all doctors and lawyers and businessmen, and they're all capitalists, and they're all people who just were chased out because Castro didn't want smart capitalists, freedom-loving people. It was the exactly what you think when it comes to the propaganda element of the Cubans who came over, because they were all the right kind of people, right? You know, they created a great Miami. And then he fell for the con that Castro wanted him to fall for. He's like, but then all the Miralitos came over, and you don't know what kind of Cuban you're dealing with anymore. Mm,
yeah.
And I'm like, dude, dad, what the hell? and he's like, I'm not saying this to be kind of racist, because growing up, I had 90% of my friends were of Hispanic and usually Cuban origin. You know, so my parents, they're friends because, you know, your kids' parents, your kids' friends' parents end up being your parents kind of thing. So 90% of my parents' friends were of Cuban background or Cuban exiles. And so there wasn't an issue there, but there was clearly a pre-1980, post-1980 philosophy there for a lot of white Miami that, you know, it's what kind of Cuban are you almost? are you a, you know, did you come over in 59, in 60? Were you a doctor in Cuba? Were you someone successful? Or were you let out of a jail in 1980 and then swam over on a raft? And what's really interesting about, Eric, your parents came over on a plane, right?
Yeah.
Well, you would argue that the people who have come over that are kind of the riffraff, according to a lot of white Miamians, are the bravest of the brave. If you've seen some of these actual rafts and crafts and things that, you know, basically some stick, you know, tree trunks tied together, braving the Florida Strait and making it to Miami, those are the kind of people I want in my society, because if they're ballsy enough to do that, then they've got all sorts of great skills. So I think that we're seeing an evolution of my generation kind of understanding and growing up with the second and third generations of Cuban immigrants. And we have a very different mentality, I think, than my father did, you know, who was here pre-1959, saw all the cool things happening in Miami in the 60s and early 70s, and then saw it all come, quote unquote, crashing down in 1980 when the Mariel boat lift takes place. And then that caused this fraction among the Miami white and black population, because I think you get the same answer from the Miami black population too. It's what kind of Cubans are we dealing with here?
Yeah. Very understandable there. And Eric, I want to go back to something you just said in passing kind of, but it really gives a lot of insight. And I think you mentioned this in the book as well about the effectiveness of the DGI, because you said basically all of their adversaries were concentrated in a very small area outside of Cuba. And so they were able to be so effective because of that kind of narrow scope of their focus. In so many ways, they could kind of specialize and get very, very good at facing the most significant and just about only adversary that they had around that time.
Not only that, I mean, how easy is it if you are actually infiltrating a community that is you? You're not the only thing you're faking is your allegiance. But you are Cuban. You speak the language. You understand. You know, you're from the same communities as these folks, right? It is not. You don't have to, you know, spend 6 months learning the language and having cultural immersion training or any of this stuff, right? That makes it exponentially easier. The fact that it was concentrated in one place that happens to be pretty close and not too difficult to get to, particularly with a regular flow of people heading to the United States. As Vince mentioned, they kind of sprinkle some folks in. I mean, 100%.
Yeah, amazing. They had so many advantages going into it that it's not surprising at all when you view it in that context that they got as good as they did and as good as they are.
Well, you're also infiltrating a community that really wants to help you, right? They are people who have just done what you supposedly have done, right? You escaped. And so you're landing in Little Havana saying, I just escaped Cuba. You're surrounded by people who want to help you succeed, who had some, it's got a pay it forward thing, right? So someone helped them. They're there now. They're in a position. They own a business, or, you know, they have a bank, an opportunity to give you loans, help you get set up in housing. And you see that again and again with the WASP network especially, but other spies who have been caught were extra devious because they played upon the generosity of an exile community, right? There's no more generous community on earth than an exile community, mm-hmm. right? These are people who by definition are living in an area at the kind of mercy of someone else. And the crazy thing that we talk about in the book is how much they were able to transform Miami in the 60s and the 70s so that when this next wave of exile comes in, they can be there to help out. And 99% of the people who are coming in from Cuba are legitimate, you know, exiles who want to be part of the American dream. But that 1% of Cuban intelligence are very, it's very easy for them to ingratiate themselves into this community. And it's almost like you're playing upon all the different things we talk about in the book, this dream of, you know, a Cuban independence, you know, without Castro, a democracy that is decades and decades and decades in the making. And you're playing upon these ideals and taking full advantage. To me, it's almost like as devious as a honey trap, right? Where you're playing on someone's emotions and their feelings and their heart. You're pulling on their heartstrings to get them to essentially fall for you. Mm-hmm. In this case, the love is for a free Cuba, and you're playing on that against the people who are most susceptible to that kind of infiltration.
Yeah. Yeah. It really does kind of tug on the heartstrings a little bit because, of course, you know, I talk about varying levels of betrayal and treachery in pretty much every mm-hmm. episode here, but there really is something about that. Like an entire community of strangers is so happy to see you and wishing you the best success, working to, you know, help you set up for success. But at the same time, you know, these DGI agents, you know, they've got this, I presume that they've got like a hyper loyalty to Fidel Castro. And they're like, what? So what do you think about Castro? And they, oh, I would kill that guy in a heartbeat if he was in front of me. And I guess I wonder if it steals their resolve or if it weakens their resolve to be around that exile community like that. You know what I mean?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not sure anyone's done a study on, I don't know how you would ever do that. How would you know on people who came over working for Cuban intelligence has decided to just be like, you know what? I kind of like it better here and just decided just to stay. I don't know that we have any evidence of that. It's much more obvious when it's a Soviet defector, you know, or someone who doesn't, you know, fit in as easily as a Cuban intelligence officer would of just being, you know what, I'm just going to become a shop owner down here in Miami mm-hmm. and raise my kids here and just not tell anybody about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's one of the fascinating things about this story is that there's still so much that we don't know. And there's so much that is being written, right? And yeah, we don't know. I mean, maybe someday we'll be able to look into the DGI archives or, you know, whatever someday. I know a lot of people are hoping to go back to Cuba and things change. But it would be fascinating to see. Yeah, I mean, there very well may be a huge number of people who were here for intelligence purposes and decided to stay. But we frankly don't know that right now.
Yeah. I mean, you guys mentioned a few, you know, public like DGI defectors who have, you know, they've given interviews and that sort of thing. But I'm sure that there were at least some who, like you said, they were just like, I'm just going to stay here as a shopkeeper and just stop, you know, paying attention to these radio signals or whatever have you that they were getting from the island.
Yeah.
Thing. Interesting. So, guys, I want to fast forward all the way to 2016, if we can, when Castro finally, you know, succumb to the CIA plot of old age or whatever you want to
success.
Call it. Success! Yeah. So that was really just a charged up chapter of your book, honestly, like explaining the false positives of the previous reports of his death, you know, in 2015, 2014, earlier, that sort of thing, and then how the city felt. So did anything really change, or what did change, I should say, in Miami and in Cuba when Castro finally passed away?
Well, I'll let Vince talk to that piece. I do want to just talk, kind of set the stage a little bit in terms of there were decades of fake reports of Fidel's death. In Cuban slang, they have something they call radio bemba, which basically means like lip radio. That's basically like chatter, right? The stuff that you hear on the street. I don't know how many times growing up in Miami, we heard that Fidel was dead or dying or on his deathbed or whatever. Anytime he was not seen for, particularly as he got older, anytime he hadn't been seen for a week or two, stuff started already churning. Hey, what's happening? Is he, you know, this and that. So it was constantly, I remember I was a Cuba analyst at the University of Miami when the serious scare happened, where he got some abdominal surgery and it didn't go well. And he was actually like, it looked like he wasn't going to make it. And the city was electric. I mean, it was nuts. And of course he survived, but there was a Fidel death fatigue after a while, where people were just like, yeah, okay, whatever. I mean, this, sure. We've heard this so many times before. So once it happened, there was a lot of expectation of change. And I'll let Vince talk about whether that actually came to pass or not.
What's interesting about it is it was anticlimactic to a degree, because at that point, Castro wasn't in charge anymore. There's two reasons. One is that he had passed along power to his brother Raul, who was about to himself pass along power to this new generation of Cuban leadership. So it wasn't like it wasn't like when Stalin died, right? It wasn't a sea change where you've got a new leader who's going to come in and give a secret speech and de-Stalinize everything. He was just a figurehead at that point. But more importantly, and this is something that we really focus on the book, is Castro by that point didn't matter as much as what we could call Castroism or Fidelism, which is essentially kind of the political philosophy that Castro had created, not only in Cuba, but throughout Latin America and even parts of Africa, the developing world. And Castroism lived on, right? And still continues to live on in places like Venezuela, especially in Venezuela, but other places as well. Even countries like Colombia that are doing much, much better than they were, but you had like FARC and other, you know, organizations there that were embracing this Castroism. Bolivia, Evo Morales.
Nicaragua.
The Castroism. Mm-hmm. Nicaragua, right? So it wasn't necessarily about the individual at that point, right? It mattered. If you'd killed Castro in 65 or 70, but by the time you get to 2016, it doesn't matter anymore, right? You get to the point, now, symbolically, of course it does, you know, rotten hell kind of thing, right? But as far as changes actually taking place, nothing happened. And the prologue of the book is my kind of perspective on this. Like, we kick it off. Eric is much more poetic in the epilogue, because it really is kind of about, you know, the American dream and everything else. My prologue is about how pissed I was that I wasn't there for it.
For when Castro died.
Because, yeah, when Castro died, I lived in Miami continuously from 78 to 94. And then 94, I left for college. And then I was in the Army for a while. And then I went to grad school. But with the exception of when I was in basic training and when I was deployed to the Balkans, every Thanksgiving I went home to Miami, right? It was, my parents were still there. A lot of my family was still there. So essentially from 1978 to 2015, with two exceptions, because one I was on the other side of the world, and another one's at Fort Knox, I went down to Miami Thanksgiving. In 2016, I had traveled the last 2 months before Thanksgiving multiple times, including the week before. And I'm like, I'm done. I don't want to deal with Thanksgiving travel. I don't want to do the airport again. What the hell could possibly happen that would matter to me? And the day after Thanksgiving, 2016, that bastard dropped dead. And I could not believe I was going to miss that party. And it was a party. I mean, it was, the pots came out in the middle of Van and Bang, and I would have been right in the middle of that. But it was a much different party than it would have been in 1996 or 1986 or 1976. Because at that point, you would have seen real change take place, I think. At that point, we'd have seen probably people starting to think about going back, you know, and reclaiming land, or at least lawsuits or other things like that. But what was crazy about 2016 is that that wasn't even a conversation, right? That it was like, no, this is our home now. Like, we live here, right? I mean, our kids now have kids, right? So the exiles' kids have kids that all grow up in Miami. And this is now their city. And I thought that was fascinating, kind of an outsider perspective, right? I was able to look at it somewhat objectively and say, number one, I'm really pissed off that I missed that party. But number two, from the outsider perspective, Miami is not going to change because it's the home of so many of these people now. And it's not Cuba anymore, right? I mean, Eric, you probably, and I'm speaking for you, but I'm going to ask you this question. I'm sure you identify as Cuban, but your home's Miami. It's not Havana.
100%. Yeah, 100%. Yeah. And I think he's absolutely right that And again, I don't want to get touchy-feely, but there is an emotional side to this story that, like, and I can understand people from other parts of the country looking. And I remember, like, there were discussions like this where they're like, oh, this is abhorrent that people are celebrating the death of anyone. And I'm like, you don't know Miami at all.
Yeah.
Clearly don't know what you're talking about. People have been waiting for this for decades.
If Steve Spurrier got hit by a bus, there'd be a celebration.
That's true.
Nick Saban, yeah.
It was one of these things where it was just this incredibly cathartic release of this entire community. And then, as Vince mentioned, it was just kind of like, okay, that was fun. But I think there was a recognition that nothing was going to change. I think there was a hope that would change something. But again, there was already a changing of the guard, and people recognized that. So I think there was a lot more bittersweet, I think, than a lot of people expected, just because there were so many people that I don't know anyone, any Cuban, either Cuban born or people like me who were born in the States, who didn't think of somebody who wasn't there, who they wish had lived to see that.
Yeah.
So that was that moment. It was an incredible moment, but sadly it hasn't changed the geopolitical calculus or what's going on the island or people's potential future all that much, except for Fidel Castro.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. So I do have one last question for you guys. It's pretty much rhetorical because I do know the answer to it, but I'm going to ask anyway. Is Miami still like a hub of crime and international intrigue, even now, even as we speak, 8 years after Castro's death?
Squeaky clean.
Exactly what I thought. Okay.
Yes, everyone, it's pure as the driven cocaine. We had to cut ourselves off. We basically had to say, okay, from this point on, I don't care what news story breaks, unless it is absolutely world-shaking. No more stories go in the book. It's literally as we're writing the last chapter, as we're like copy editing the book, there are more stories about Miami and international intrigue, whether it was, a spy here or this person working at Florida International University was spying for so-and-so or the Russians or this Mexican national living in Miami was spying for the And the last thing we included was the Bolsonaro thing, basically as almost an afterthought, like, oh, you know what? This is too juicy not to include. Because what's wonderful about that is, and this is, if you know this story, everyone assumed that he was in Miami because of the reputation of Miami. He actually wasn't. But still people blamed Miami, which is glorious. I mean, it's just wonderful for kind of a cherry on top of this. But since we turned the book in, so we're talking months and months and months ago, there was enough material to write two more chapters of what's happened during that period in Miami, whether it was corruption specifically dealing with foreign policy toward Cuba in the Miami government, or it was spies, people who worked in the area. I mean, Ana Montes got released. That's an interesting story, obviously. She was part of this major spy ring against the United States. Last week, they arrested a spy who was a former ambassador for the United States who was spying for Cuba. So we're in a position where we just kind of had to say, enough. Maybe there'll be a part two at some point down the road. I mean, you almost have enough material for half a book already.
Yeah. I mean, stay tuned because, it's pretty much writing itself.
Oh, man, fantastic. Well, this is a subject that I clearly love to return to again and again, and you guys do as well. So I look forward to anything else you write. On that note, I know that the book is out tomorrow, right?
Absolutely.
Tuesday, the 23rd, April 23rd.
Yeah, so, you can get it anywhere that great books about Miami are sold.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah, the book, for those of you who have already forgotten the title from earlier, is Covert City, The Cold War, and the Making of Miami by Vince Houghton and Eric Driggs. So, guys, a really fascinating book. I really enjoyed it, and I just love this story. Do you guys have any plans now that you've kind of put this to rest? Are you going to co-author something else, or are you moving on to other projects already?
Eric's going to go save Baltimore Harbor as a Coast Guard. Eric has a real job. I am actually, 3 days after we turned in this book, I got a call I couldn't turn down to co-author another book. And actually, I can't give you details, but it's very similar to what you mentioned. This is a person who lived a very specific, interesting event in the Cold War and is just not necessarily ready to write this the way it kind of needs historical background.
And so it was dropped in my lap and I couldn't say no because it's too juicy. I'll come back and talk to you in a year or two when we get it put together. But yeah, I can't divulge the secret now, but it's going to be fun.
Great. Well, my interest has peaked already, just like it was when we talked about nuking the moon earlier. So glad to hear that. I can't get enough of these stories, obviously. So a lot more stories out there to tell, no doubt about it. Guys, I really enjoyed the book and I wish you the best of luck with the sales and everything. So make sure that you guys pick up Covert City when you get the chance. And I have to tell you, we've talked a lot about Miami here. We've covered, you know, maybe a third of the content of the book. Honestly, there's so many things that we haven't really covered, like the Alpha 66 group shooting up the Cuban coastline and Omega 7 setting bombs and shooting Cuban diplomats in the United States and all manner of wild activities. And it's a lot of action oriented stuff that happened outside of Miami or off the coast as well that I think you're really going to enjoy. And you won't hardly be able to find it anywhere else besides this book. So make sure you pick it up and give it a read because I think you'll all really enjoy it.
Thanks. Appreciate that.
Thanks for your time.
Absolutely. So you guys have public profiles. If people want to look you up, you have a website or social media pages, anything like that you want to share so people can follow along with the next book or the operations in Baltimore or whatever have you?
Not a lot. We're both kind of spooky in that regard, but I do have a Twitter feed at Intel Historian. We probably should do that, Eric, you know, so people could actually learn a little bit about us. But right now we don't.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Vince has a PhD in this stuff, but just listening to his stories and reading stuff like this, I get a little creeped out with having a big social media presence, just, you know, hearing Intel stories and spook stories and whatnot. So I definitely need to get better at that. So yeah, we'll definitely work on that.
Well, it's good to be reachable when you have some stuff to share, but I can tell you that my own social media presence has grown unexpectedly large and it's brought a lot of people that I would prefer not to interact with along with it. So there is certainly a downside to that on a daily or weekly basis sometimes.
Yeah.
So word to the wise.
Yeah.
Careful what you would.
I'm sure we'd have a lot of CGI followers. A lot of Cuban intel guys would be hitting us up, DMing us and whatnot.
Yeah. I don't doubt it at all. Some unusual people out there, no question about it. But thanks again, guys. This has been a fascinating topic, and I really appreciate you taking the time to write the book and to discuss it with me today.
Awesome. Appreciate you having us.
Thanks, Justin. Appreciate it.
All right. Great. Thanks, Eric. Thanks, Vince. Take care. If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft 101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around because there's lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.